Hey everyone, and welcome to Builders, a podcast from BetaWorks Studios about the amazing people who build things, the makers and the doers, not just the talkers, the people that are helping shape the world we live in. I'm Leila Oweda, and I'll be your guide. In Builders, we bring you a diverse mix of thinkers and leaders from the startup ecosystem. All the shows are recorded live at BetaWorks Studios, our club for builders located in the Meatpacking District of New York City. If you want to know what a club for builders really is, visit betaworks-studios.com. But these podcasts are a good reflection of life in studios. One week, it might be a discussion on crypto, the next, on how technology is affecting music festivals. In this particular episode, you'll hear from Jaron Lanier. Jaron is currently a researcher at Microsoft, but is also a scientist, musician, and author. He's probably best known for being an early expert on virtual reality. His books, Who Owns the Future? And You Are Not a Gadget, were bestsellers, and Dawn of Everything was recently named Best Book of 2017 by The Wall Street Journal, The Economist, and Vox. He's just released a new book, 10 Arguments for Deleting Your Social Media Accounts Right Now. In this hugely popular session, Jaron will go through some of the main ideas in the book. He starts with some general philosophical warnings, such as this.
And we're starting to seem crazy to each other. Mankind has real problems to face, and if we can't face them with collective sanity, we will die.
But Jaron is not all doom and gloom. He's also careful to put forward some ideas that might make social media better, such as copying the Netflix model and making people pay for Facebook. You'll hear him talk about things like peak social media.
If it was peak social media, like, yeah, you'd pay for it because it'd be a great deal.
Social media is a great deal? Let's see. For the whole talk, stay tuned for the next 20 minutes. Jaron is interviewed by Jeremy Price from Helio, a startup that connects great thinkers and authors with readers. Jeremy is also a member of BetaWorks Studios.
Hi there. This is Jeremy from Helio, and I am here with Jaron Lanier. Jaron is a computer scientist, he is a musician and a writer, and he just came out with a brand new book called 10 Arguments for Deleting Your Social Media Accounts Right Now. So Jaron, thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Of course, of course. So first of all, I do realize that there is a little bit of irony here. I mean, we are telling people to delete their social media accounts, and yet this is a live stream on Facebook. So,
you know, let me say a thing about that.
All right, all right.
The first thing is, I don't actually tell people that I know that they personally should delete their accounts. I'm presenting arguments they should consider. I'm very clear always that each person's life is different. Only you can know what's right for you. Mm-hmm. So I don't say you must delete your argument, your social media accounts. Mm-hmm. I say, here's some arguments. I really want you to think about it. Mm-hmm. That's all I'm saying. Be thoughtful. You make your own decisions. I can guess you.
That's fair. That's all fair. Right. So before we get into exactly what these arguments are, I mean, you've been in the tech space for so long. Now, was there a specific moment when you realized that we were really in trouble when it comes to social media?
You know what's funny is, yeah, and it was around 92.
Wow.
So it was like way before the internet. Because, right around, coincident with the internet and the rise of the web. Because here's what happened. There were a few developments right at the start. Mm-hmm. One was Tim Berners-Lee came up with this web protocol on top of the internet that lost context. Like if something linked to something else, that thing didn't know it was being linked to, and so therefore you couldn't know who the author was. You could never hope to have an economy where people would be paid for something. It became clear that sort of anybody could say anything. There'd be no authentication. There was no representation of people built in, only sites and computers, and so there'd be fake people. Like, all that stuff was clear from the start. And then the other thing was, to go along with that, there was this advertising business model, and back then we didn't call them bots, we called them agents, but the idea of like automated generation of feeds to try to get people, and that combination of things seemed to me to be highly dystopian, and I started writing about it. My first essay that said essentially the same thing was 92, and the thing about it is that, if anybody wants to look it up, the first one's called Agents of Alienation, because we used to call bots agents. And the thing is, in those days, I wasn't alone. There were others who also saw the danger. And I got to say, It was pretty lonely, though. And now it isn't. Now there's a whole world of younger engineers and entrepreneurs in the tech community who are really thinking ethically and morally. And all of a sudden, the atmosphere is different. You're seeing people within the tech companies really concerned about the impact they're having on the world and really thinking about it. So everything's turned around. Yeah, I've been here a long time. I'm happy to still be here. I'm happy to not be alone. I mean, that's really great.
Right, right. I'm sure. Well, it's nice to see that. Hopefully your message has been getting across slowly but surely. So now, would you say that, you know, broadly, you know, what are some of these arguments why we should get, you know, maybe get rid of our social media accounts?
Okay, well, there are 10 of them.
Right. It's hard to sum all of them up. That's right. But just, you know, broadly.
Okay. One of them is that, look, a lot of the stuff that people experience when they're using social media is genuine and positive. And I'm the last person who's going to deny that. Right. I mean, so the fact that there's good stuff there is beyond question. And in fact, I worked very hard along with a lot of other people to make the internet possible back in the day, and this is we exactly wanted these sorts of things. Like if you had a rare illness, you could find other people with something in common instead of being all alone. That's what we wanted, and that's happened, and that is great. There's this other thing going on at the same time that's totally severable. It doesn't have to be there. And that's this behind-the-scene engine that's getting all your data. It's like constantly surveilling you. And then it's tweaking what you experience just slightly from time to time in order to try to weasel its way into some slight framing that'll get you to change a little bit, get your emotions piqued, change what you're interested in, and eventually adjust your behavior a little bit so you'll buy something different. But the problem is that the side effect of that background engine, mm-hmm. the behavior manipulation machine, makes you cranky, makes you irritable, makes you paranoid, makes you sad. Even Facebook's own researchers have published that. At first they said, well, hey, we can deliberately make you sad without you realizing we're doing it to you. Yay, us. Yeah. That was really creepy. And then more recently they said, well, even if we're not trying, we're kind of having that effect. Mm-hmm. You know, so basically there's this slight darkening of the world, this slight crazy making that just kind of gradually, it's like, I like to use the metaphor of compound interest. Like, even if you're only earning a little bit of compound interest, over time, if you're deliberate and focused, that can turn into a pretty big deal, right?
Right, right.
Same thing, like, you're darkening the world. And, like, at any particular moment, it's not that big a deal. But cumulatively, it starts to create a world where you don't trust elections anymore. Mm. It starts to create a world that's more divided. Mm-hmm. It creates families who are more divided. Mm-hmm. It creates a bizarre sense of unreality where people don't know what's true or what to trust. And, you know, it's just too high a price to pay. And hey, Facebook, love you guys. A lot of my friends are at Facebook. I've known a lot of the top people at Facebook from the beginning. You guys can make more money and do better as a business with a different business plan. I want you to thrive. I'm not opposed to you. Nobody is, really. We all want you to be successful. Everybody likes the, you know, remember, until 3 minutes ago, we all loved the tech industry. Let's get back there and let's have a successful tech industry without destroying the world. I mean,
Right.
That's the pitch.
gotcha. So then, I mean, and you bring up this really astonishing point in the book, which is that if everybody's social media feeds are being tweaked all the time, then really no one's looking at the same world anymore when they look at the world through the lens of social media, right?
Right.
So what does that do to our ability to empathize with one another and come to some sort of agreement on political issues?
Yeah, see, the use of the word empathy in tech marketing was my idea originally, way back. I used to talk about how I started the virtual reality thing, and I used to say virtual reality could create empathy because you could experience the world from somebody else's perspective. Mm-hmm. But what we're doing instead is we're giving everybody unique perspectives that nobody else can appreciate. Mm-hmm. So if I'm talking to you and what you're seeing of the world is a feed that I can't see that's different from what I could imagine. And I'm not just talking about dark ads, although I am talking about them, but I'm also just talking about the whole framing, the subtle way that the order in which you see things, the particular ads you see, the particular framings, the particular things that are emphasized with you are different than for me. You're looking at a different world.
Right.
So when you start to have a reaction, I don't know where it's coming from, and you just start to seem a little crazy to me. Mm-hmm. And we're starting to seem crazy to each other. Mm-hmm. And that is, I don't think that's beyond annoying, that's beyond heartbreaking. It really becomes a survival issue because mankind has real problems to face.
Yeah.
And if we can't face them with collective sanity, we will die. So I view this as an existential issue.
Right, right, right. And I think rightly so. Mm-hmm. So then, you know, you mentioned that the problem isn't so much social media itself, but it's the business model behind it all, right?
Yeah, so. I make clear in the book, I'm not asking you to never be on social media again necessarily. Sure. I'm saying get off it for a while so you can get some perspective. You can know yourself outside of it, especially if you're young.
Right.
But also to honestly to put pressure on the companies.
Yeah.
What I say in the book is that this is not like the tobacco industry where it's all harm and no benefit. Mm-hmm. It's all addiction with no nutrition or whatever. Instead, this is more like lead paint where it's like we still want to paint houses. Let's just make lead-free paint. So we still want social media. Let's just make manipulation-free social media, then we can have a survivable society and what we love. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, why not?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And so if we do have a different kind of social media, one where maybe there's a subscription model, right? Like you mentioned how with things like Netflix and Hulu and HBO, we pay for these things, and now, partially as a result, we're living in peak TV. You know, TV has never been better.
Yeah. So, I like that example because there was a fair fight there.
Right.
Back when Facebook was being founded, a whole lot of people in the tech world thought that the traditional idea of you hire people to make a movie or a TV show and then you pay to watch it, that was going to go away. That was old-fashioned. And instead, everything would be like the Wikipedia, where you'd have an army of volunteers. They'd create better stuff because they'd have the wisdom of the crowd on their side. And so there was a fair fight between people trying to do that and then other ventures like Netflix.
Right.
And Netflix won. I mean, like, fair and square.
Right.
Like, there's no question people are happy to pay for stuff that they actually want. Mm-hmm. And then what they get is better. Like, everybody's happier.
Right.
So, you know, people sometimes curdle at the idea, oh my God, I couldn't pay for Facebook. Well, you know what? If it was better, if it had good, unmanipulative advice, if it wasn't infested with fake people and Russian intelligence warfare units,
right.
Like, if it was peak social media, like, yeah, you'd pay for it because it'd be a great deal.
Yeah.
And yeah, some people couldn't afford to pay for it, and I believe strongly that those people would need some kind of subsidy or arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
Not a hard problem. I mean, remember in the era of books, we had this thing called the public library.
Imagine that.
But yeah, we can figure that problem out. That's not a difficult problem.
Mm-hmm.
But Netflix. And there's another side to it, too. Right now, if you look at the press releases coming out of all the tech companies, they'll say, we're engaged in this massive AI race, right? Including Facebook.
Yep.
We're going to make these artificial intelligences. We're going to make these robots. They're going to put you out of work. You're going to be obsolete. You're going to be worthless. Mm. We're going to put you on a giant kind of welfare called a basic income model. And then that'll be it forever. And I think that's, like, really stupid, because if that were true, then the companies wouldn't need to steal all your data in order to make their AIs. I mean, you're still, AI still needs you because it relies on your data.
Right.
So if you were paid fairly for your data, you wouldn't be treated as being valueless, but rather as valuable in a new way.
Right.
And what's always happened in the past is that when a new technology comes along, it shuts down some industries but gives birth to others, and people find new kinds of jobs, right?
Right.
Why can't we do that this time? So if there was a system where you're paying for Facebook, also you get paid. You make something that's viral and it's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
That should be a big payday for you, and you should get royalties on it in the future when people continue to look at it or reuse it or something. Like, it's just a more sensible, dignified, and honest way to do things.
Right. No, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I can't help but wonder, too, with your expertise in VR, what would, like, if virtual reality truly does become a more integral part of social media, what might that look like, and what kind of possibilities would that open up?
Oh, well, look, the term virtual reality was originally meant to be the social or the multi-user version of virtual worlds. Mm. That was its definition.
Mm.
So by the original definition, when I made it up, a single person wearing a headset isn't even in virtual reality yet, right?
Yeah,
the whole
point
was to make it social.
Mm.
And making it social, I think, could be really fantastic, because when you combine the wisdom of the body you can access through modifying your avatar. This gets into a whole thing, like, believe me.
I bet.
Like right now, when people think about virtual reality, they sort of think, well, if I wanted to teach kids geometry in virtual reality, I'd put a big triangle in front of them in a virtual world. No. You turn them into the triangle. Right? Virtual reality is all about body wisdom. And then when you combine that together, when multiple kids can form a shared geometric structure and explore it, kind of like dance.
Yeah.
Things get very beautiful, very intense, and learning becomes more profound. I mean, it's incredible. And even now, after all these billions of dollars in investment, very few people have experienced the stuff that I think is really good about VR. So I think you have a lot of delights awaiting you if you're interested in VR.
Yeah.
You just barely started.
Right. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And I remember reading at one point that, you know, if you turn, you know, that person into the triangle, you're almost piggybacking on their own sense of, like, narcissism or egotism, right? Because I'm this thing now. I better learn all about me, you know?
Yeah. If Facebook stays in virtual reality, I don't think they're going to have any need for me to advise them on how to leverage people's narcissism.
Interesting.
I think they're going to figure that piece out.
Right. Yeah.
I think that's something Facebook knows about. Yeah.
Yeah. I think so. One other thing that comes to mind is that it seems like, you know, all of these ideas that you're sharing come as such a breath of fresh air, because it seems like so many leaders in tech are content to just kind of have people become lab rats, for better or worse, put in like this Skinner box, right?
Yeah.
And that strikes me as interesting, because it seems like in other fields as well, there's this strange like attack on what it means to be human, where it's like neuroscientists are telling us that we're just fancy machines and nothing else, and philosophers are saying that consciousness doesn't even exist. And so, you know, from your perspective, as someone who really does champion these human values of freedom and agency and dignity, you know, why is it that this whole notion of being human is under attack from so many sides?
Well, I think it's a power trip, because if you look at the rhetoric from Silicon Valley, on the one hand, it'll say, well, all you ordinary people out there, you're like computers, you're just programs, we'll upload you someday, we'll give you immortality if you believe in us, more or less, like like a medieval church or something.
Yeah.
It's like indulgences. But then at the same time, they'll say, but that magic hacker or the magic entrepreneur, these are the people with magic free will. They have magical abilities to dent the universe and Steve Jobs. So it's not so much that they're saying they don't believe in free will or they don't believe that people are magical. It's just that they're saying, hey, you guys over there, you're the ones who aren't magical, but hey, we're really magical.
Interesting.
Yeah. So it's actually a completely hypocritical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, yeah, it definitely does seem that way. Yeah, so then, but you're saying that, you know, if we return like a sense of economic dignity to people, then that's beneficial not just to them but to these companies as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, I've been working with economist colleagues and with students and trying to run models of what this would be like for the tech industry if we just shifted. Like, so I think the economics of a future Facebook should be some combination of like Etsy, where it's person-to-person commerce, except for information instead of handicrafts.
Okay.
And then Netflix, where there's some kind of a fee-based thing. It could be a monthly fee like Netflix, or it could be some kind of micropayment as you go.
Right.
A lot of people get tied up in which of those is better. I don't, you know, either of them is great. Like, I'm really happy either way, whatever works. But if you look at that and you imagine a company like Facebook taking a cut of that in exchange for making it work, hey, that's great.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
It's kind of like a lot of the people who were part of founding these companies also started PayPal, and PayPal makes money on the float, you know?
Yeah.
Why not? Like what basically this Facebook could be, this really trusted intermediary that's helping people connect, helping people do commerce with each other. So far as I can tell, it would make it a bigger company. It would get it up into the top five of the world, where it isn't right now.
Right now,
and there's a kind of a funny thing. If you look at the tech giants, there's basically five tech giants now. Only two of them rely on this background machine. In the book, I call it the bummer machine, some people don't like, because it's a bit of a butt joke. But it's behaviors of users manipulated and made into an empire for rent, whatever. But anyway, if that machine is the only way you make profit, it kind of ties your hands and you can never diversify.
Right.
So the only two companies which rely on it are Google and Facebook. And no matter how hard they try, and it's almost comic with Google, they can spin off endless new cost centers. Hey, we're going to cure death. We're going to make these balloons that'll go everywhere. They'll do all this crazy stuff, but they can never diversify their profit centers.
Interesting.
The other three companies that don't rely on it still do it a bit, but the other three are Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, right? And they have successfully diversified, because they're not addicted to this stupid thing.
Right.
So it's actually good for companies. It's good for shareholders. This is not in any sense an attack on the companies. It's an attempt to make them better.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And you mentioned Etsy a second ago, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah.
So, you know, so if this new change takes place, does the world suddenly become a much better place for artists and musicians and journalists and some people that have kind of been left by the wayside of this digital revolution?
Yeah, you know, my sense is that when people have a chance to directly support freelancers who are making information-based value, they rise to the challenge. And Patreon's a good example of that.
I see.
But it still is kind of a niche thing. Like, if it was just made standard, I think the world would become much better, because I think there would be higher quality and much more broad investigative reporting. Mm. Like, right now, there's very little local investigative reporting, and I don't think that's good. I think that's a really bad thing.
Yeah.
So, I think people would rise to the challenge. I think it would be really great. It would make the world a better place.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
And I also, you know, I wonder about this partially because I know that your own background is so diverse. Like, I understand that you've had visiting professor appointments in like 10 different academic departments.
Yeah.
Musician as well.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, you know, having such an interdisciplinary background, and I'm especially curious about music, actually, how has that influenced your thinking and your work in tech and vice versa?
Yeah, so this, if anybody wants to have a really diverse career where you do a bunch of stuff, there's a secret I'll share with you.
Okay.
It's called cross procrastination.
All right.
It's like cross training, except the idea is that you get to be lazy all the time.
Great.
Every time you're doing something, you frame it psychologically as a way of avoiding this other thing you have to do.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
That's the secret.
Love it.
Yeah. So I have a fundamentally lazy personality, and that's the secret to my success. As far as how it's informed my tech stuff, I have been a working musician. Mm-hmm. Like I've been both everything from being a sidewalk busker to being a signed artist in the 90s. So I've experienced different economic niches as a musician. And when people are starting to tell me, oh, this will be good for musicians, I actually can speak from experience, like, nah, that's a bunch of crap. It'll be good for a small number of musicians and then a few posers who have trust funds. Like, this is actually not great. And we've entered it, like, basically into a casino world where, like, let's say you're a musician, you have to self-fund and take all the risks to get your YouTube video out. And then some pool of those people will do well. But the problem is they're taking all the risk, and then the center, which in this case would be Google, is getting all the benefit without sharing that risk.
Right.
And so in a true market economy, everybody links their risks to their rewards. Mm-hmm. If you have a system like a casino where the center has to take no risks ever and the risks are all out there for the little people, that's a casino economy. Or actually, more properly, it's a centrally planned communist economy.
Interesting.
And I think it's fundamentally dysfunctional.
Yeah. So then if you take a model like YouTube, like I understand YouTube does, it does, you know, pay some of like the creators that are most successful.
They've been taking steps, and I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
But the problem is they can't give up that communist central planning model. Mm. They still have this idea that we're going to be the wise planner in the center. We're going to decide how many people get paid and how much.
Okay.
And like, you gotta, to enjoy the incredible benefits of a market economy, you gotta take that very difficult step of saying, hey, maybe I'm not infinitely wise.
Interesting.
Maybe I should let the market function. And so this next step that YouTube has to take, and I know it's emotionally difficult. I know it's like taking a jump into the pool and you don't know if it's a hot or cold pool, or like you're scared. I get it. But take the plunge. The water's fine. What you got to do is say, no, actually, we're going to let the market decide.
Right.
We'll let people pay for this. We'll let people earn. And we're going to let it happen incrementally according to how successful they are. Let it be a real market.
Nice.
Let it be broad. Open it to everybody.
Gotcha. And so, you know, if it...
And stop advertising on it. Like, that's the thing. If you stop, do that, but then at the same time, get rid of the ads in proportion to the rise of this paid economy. Because as long as the feed is related to the advertisement, you are creating this manipulative world that's like this red carpet to the Russians and other bad actors. Mm-hmm. And the more you put effort in trying to stamp them out, whether you're hiring tens of thousands of low-paid people or trying to run algorithms, all you're doing is breeding smarter criminals.
Right.
You're breeding a criminal underground. You've already done that with your search.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just shut it down. Stop the advertising thing, and then you undo the whole incentive structure that's an invitation to criminality.
Right.
Just move to a paid model.
Interesting.
Come on, Sundar. You know it's the right thing to do.
Absolutely.
In your heart. Zuck, you know it already in your
heart. Come on, Zuck.
You got it.
We know you're watching, too.
Yeah, you know it's true.
Awesome. So I think I've just got maybe one more question for you.
Yeah.
If I do decide to, to get mostly off social media, is there, can I keep one? Or is it the type of thing where, they're all equally bad?
I genuinely don't know you. I really feel each person's situation is different. Mm. And the last thing I want to do is tell somebody that I know better than them.
Fair.
I do want to tell people that if you've never experienced being off it, there's no way you can know yourself well enough to answer the question for yourself.
Right.
All right. That's the most I can tell you. I really, really strongly believe this is a decision you have to make yourself, and I don't know enough to do that.
Fair enough.
All right.
Well, Jaron Lanier. Yeah.
Hey.
Thanks so much for joining me, man.
Sure.
Hey,
man.
Thanks.
So that was Jaron Lanier. We're very grateful to have him in the space. Obviously, he's not on social media, but you can find out more about him at jaronlanier.com. His book is out now. If you were a member of BetaWorks Studios and came to the talk, you would have got a free copy. Actually, there are still a few free copies floating around the space. Contact me and I'll see what I can do. For more information on studios and why it's like the best bit of a conference, the part where you learn stuff, hang out, eat free food, but without the hassle of trying to get on conference Wi-Fi, visit betaworks-studios.com. We'll be happy to give you a tour or spring you a day pass. For the next episode of Builders, we're going to look at what it might be like for blockchain to become mainstream.
So I think we're at the very beginning of understanding what this cultural phenomenon is all about.
That was Jason Goldberg from OST, or Open Simple Token. To hear that episode and all the other Builders, just subscribe, sit back, and take it all in. I'm Leila Oweda. This was Builders. Until next time, happy building.